This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Andrew McLeod's new book about inequality in BC opens with a quote by BC's child advocate Mary Ellen Turple Lafond. She says, "The rising tide lifts all boats, unless you're living in the trailer park, in which case you're flooded out." McLeod tackles the causes and costs of rapidly growing income disparity in the province in A Better Place on Earth, The Search for Fairness in Super Unequal British Columbia. Andrew McLeod is Legislative Bureau Chief for the independent online magazine The Tyee, and he's joined me this morning from his home in Victoria. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Sean.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks a lot for your interest.
How unequal is British Columbia in comparison with the rest of Canada?
Well, it depends how you measure. If you look at income, we are either the most unequal or the second most unequal. We sort of traded back and forth with Alberta over the last decade or so. But if you look at accumulated wealth, you know, assets minus what people owe, we are actually far and away the most unequal province in Canada.
Oh, we're number one.
Yeah, number one in something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, part of that, it's a product of high real estate prices and such, where people who actually own real estate have ended up, you know, quite wealthy, where people who do not, you know, people who rent or people who are younger, end up with not much. So that's part of why there's such a big disparity. It's not the only thing, but it's a driving factor.
Yeah, one of the amazing stats in your book is something like 10% of the population in BC owns something like 50% of the wealth.
Yeah, I think it's 56%, mm-hmm. Something like that. And if you look at the bottom end, you know, the bottom 50%, so half of all people own something like 3 or 4% of the wealth. And if you go down further than that to the bottom 10%, they actually have negative wealth. You know, on average, they have something like negative $10,000. So it's people who are in debt.
Again, another striking fact from your book is you say that Jimmy Patterson, I think everybody knows Jimmy Patterson, he's the car and billboard magnate here in British Columbia. You say that he is so rich he could buy a Toyota Prius for more than 250,000 households in BC. Is it this kind of wealth that's responsible for these statistics?
That's part of it. Jimmy Patterson's one person, so he obviously pulls up the median. But you know, it's really the rising gap between high paid people and low paid people. So it's the 1% doing excessively well. People in certain professions, such as doctors, some lawyers, dentists, veterinarians, people like that are in the top 10%. Sports stars, entertainment folks, you know, there are other people besides Jimmy Patterson who are doing well, but it is also business people. And then you mentioned cars and billboards, but you know, it's also tuna and resorts and fishing resorts, I believe, and Ripley's, believe it or not, in Ontario. And when you go down the list of the things that the Patterson Group owns, there's all kinds of stuff in there that you probably didn't realize. You know, grocery stores as well.
What effect have government policies had on fostering this inequality in the province?
Huge. I mean, if you look at the prime push of our politics in the last 10 or 15 years, it's been on low taxes, and that has to come from somewhere, right? So when the government makes decisions that allow people like Jimmy Patterson or other people in the top 1% or 10% to keep more of what they earn, it means they have to cut somewhere else, right? It's money they don't have to spend on healthcare or education or welfare. So you look at, the welfare rates, and they went up, I think 2007 was the last time, like 8 years ago, and before that it had been a long time, and even then they didn't go up much. And, you look back to sort of 2002, 2003 and all the efforts to prevent people from coming onto the welfare system, the cuts to legal aid, the cuts to child care. There were a lot of things that were sort of gutted that helped people out at the bottom end. So they did both things at once. It's almost like the policy was deliberately to grow inequality.
Now, the metaphor you quote at the beginning of the of your book is the rising tide that will lift all boats. Is there any evidence that the increase in wealth at the top is making things better for people at the bottom? You have that kind of trickle-down effect.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I mean, that's long been the argument, right? That's Reaganomics and Margaret Thatcher and Mike Harris in Ontario and Gordon Campbell here, that if you let people at the top keep more money, it'll find its way down. But I don't think there is any real evidence for that, and you can sort of reduce it to the point where it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you don't tax it all and spread it around, then there's less money flowing in the economy. So there is evidence out there that economies that are, countries and jurisdictions that are more equal actually end up with stronger economies as well.
And so we have this growing wealth gap in British Columbia. What are the consequences of this gap?
Yeah, there are many. I mean, some of the work I refer to in the book, the spirit level out of the UK, they connect things like crime rates, domestic violence, violence in general, teen pregnancy, lower life expectancy, all these kinds of things are associated with jurisdictions that are more unequal. In BC, you see it in the debt levels that people take on. You see it in things like people, we're the least likely, how to phrase it. There was a study a few years ago where they looked at why people didn't buy prescription medicines, drugs that they'd been prescribed, and BC had the highest rate of people saying, I didn't buy my drugs because I couldn't afford it. And while there might be good reasons not to take drugs, because you can't afford it isn't really one of them.
Do you see any signs that people are just getting up and leaving BC?
Over the last few years there has been sort of migration out, like interprovincial migration. In general, people have tended to come here. There is a question about, how do people do when they come here? And you look at patterns of immigration and how long it's taken immigrants to do well in the economy. In the past, it's taken a lot less time than it does now. And partly, BC is part of a wider trend. I'm not sure that Alberta, like I said off the top, of Alberta and us, in terms of income, we've traded back and forth for who's the most unequal over the years. And I'm not sure that, we are part of a global trend. We're just sort of at the forefront of it for Canada.
Mary Turpel-Lafond, the BC Child's advocate, she makes a distinction between transitional and deeply entrenched poverty. Where do we find the deeply entrenched poverty in British Columbia?
We see it in various places, but primarily among First Nations. I think she's talking the generational. You look back at sort of what we've done as a colonial power here, where you had the residential schools, you had the taking away of land, the dispossession of people, and then the putting them on reserves and taking away opportunities to participate fully in the economy, and then 100 years later we're seeing the results of that. So that would be the prime place, but you see it in just anywhere where families are trying to raise children in poverty and there isn't money for enough food or for the what they need to go to school. Supplies and that sort of thing, you see it sort of passed on through the generations.
And what other demographics are at the bottom of the income ladder?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole range. The book came out of a series of Hutai, and for the most part I stayed away from the question of who is unequal, because you risk sort of making a hierarchy of vulnerability, but to ignore it isn't really helpful either. So, at the top basically you have white, middle-aged men, and then beyond that, gender is a factor, race is a factor, immigration status is a factor, First Nation status is a factor, disability, people who are disabled have a harder time finding work they need to make average incomes in the provincial economy. So there are a whole lot of factors, and if you have more than one of those going on, it all affects how you do.
Now, you list almost, in your book, you list almost 40 ideas or 40 solutions to inequality. some even at no cost to the government. What's standing in the way of implementing these ideas?
Oh, it's completely political will, I think. You know, you look at things like the debate over what the minimum wage should be. I mean, that's one that doesn't cost the government much to do, and yet they're reluctant to raise it in any significant kind of way. I mean, we had a 20 cents an hour raise announced just recently. You know, employment standards is another one where it doesn't really cost them a whole lot to do, and it would just mean that you know, people are treated more fairly when they go to work. You know, there would be you know, they used to have rules like that when you were called in for a shift, you had to be called in for at least 4 hours. Well, that was done away with 2001, 2002, somewhere in there. You know, that sort of thing, again, doesn't cost the government anything, but makes a big difference for somebody who's, you know, getting by on a low income. But yeah, no, ultimately it comes down to will. I mean, as I said before, it's almost like we've had deliberate policies that seem, you know, intent on increasing inequality, and, you know, we could do the opposite. And part of why I had that listen there is I didn't want the book to be a downer. You know, it easily could have been a book about, you know, everything that had sort of gone wrong over the last 10 or 15 years, and that's in there, but I also wanted it to be really clear that there are solutions. You know, you look around the world and there are things going on that we could certainly borrow from.
What about media coverage of this issue? I know your online magazine, The Tie, covers it, these kind of issues, but and I've seen articles about, for example, you know, how unaffordable houses are, but you don't really... I don't see these reports or these articles going beyond reporting just the general facts of how unaffordable houses are. They don't go to the reasons behind it. Do you see the media coverage as adequate on this issue?
I don't think it's adequate considering how big a deal it is in the lives of so many people. You know, it's one of those things. Like I would say it's one of the defining issues of our time, right? Like it's up there with climate change and sort of the general environmental destruction. That said, I mean, when you start looking, like there has been coverage. You know, around the time I wrote my series for the Tie, the Globe and Mail did a series Canada-wide that also looked at some of the factors. You know, they went into the decline in union jobs and the changing nature of work and that kind of thing. The Economist magazine has been taking an interest in this. You know, they're very libertarian magazine, but they have seen it as an issue. Lots of people, like, you know, Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who was formerly the governor of the Bank of Canada, he's been talking about the issue, and that gets reported in the States. It's been a big issue. You have people like Warren Buffett saying they should be taxed more. You know, it's out there in the broader discussion. I would say we don't get sort of focused discussion of it in the mainstream media, but, you know, it's a bit of a luxury for someone like me to have time to, you know, write a 10-part series and then turn it into a book.
So you didn't write your book to be a downer. Where do you see signs of hope?
Well, I would say, you know, there are things that are winnable. Like, you know, you look at minimum wage was frozen in BC from 2001 to 2011, and after Christy Clark became premier, she has raised it. You know, two announcements for increases, not enough, but it, you know, they've moved on it. We had the whole debate here about you know, people, single parents on welfare being allowed to keep child support payments, and personally, I think it's a fairly small amount of money for a fairly small number of people. But it's an amount of money that will make a difference for those people. And there was a fight for that for, I don't know, it was like a year or so of debate. And finally, the government moved on that in the budget in February. And that'll be, you know, they'll make that change in September. So things, you know, you do see some battles get won. But I think, you know, you have to have an eye on, well, where are we going? And you know, what would a fairer society look like? And it takes a push. And the other place I would say I see hope is the push that there is already from the public. You look at the I Don't Know More movement a couple years ago, and you look at, you know, the Occupy movement and the success they had raising awareness of the issue. You know, I don't think they were really focused on what should be done about it, but they did make it common knowledge that the 1% has done excessively well at the expense of everybody else.
Well, Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today and keeping this issue on the forefront for us.
Yeah, no, thank you to you.
I've been speaking with author and journalist Andrew McLeod. His book, A Better Place on Earth, has just come out. It's available from Harbor Publishing.